Welcome to Mixtapes. I'm your host, Eric Stanglin, and today we've got a great guest. He's an American writer and science professor. His new book is The Six Pack, and it's out April 2nd. And I've got an advanced copy, and it's a must-read. Welcome to the show, Mr. Brad Baloukjian. How are you doing today, sir?
Doing well, Eric. Doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, man. Thanks for making the time. I know you're a busy guy, and you've got a lot of interviews, and you're getting a lot of great press on this new book. I'm really excited. But let's talk about you for a little bit before we get into the books, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Where'd you grow up, and what was your childhood like?
I grew up, right now I'm sitting in the house that I grew up in, which is really cool, in a small town called Greenville, Rhode Island, kind of northern Rhode Island, close to Mass. Although everything in Rhode Island is close to Massachusetts because it's such a small state. But I'm looking out here on a lake, a nice little lake that I grew up on. And yeah, it was a pretty idyllic childhood here. Really nice that the house is still in our family. I can come back and hang out and kind of post up here as I get ready for my book release.
Man, that's wild. That's so cool. The memories must be just flooding back to you from that childhood house. I got to ask this. I'm an East Coaster too. I grew up in New Jersey. How did you become a Phillies fan being that close to Boston?
Yeah, by all rational accounts, I should be a Red Sox fan. But a lot of my things that I like are quite irrational. And so this particular case, the story is kind of ridiculous. When I was about 5 years old, I got really into baseball because my dad was into baseball. Ultimately, what inspired my first book, The Wax Pack. And I was never one to follow the crowd. And so in being a free agent fan, looking around, who am I going to support? Well, the Red Sox, you know, they were the obvious choice, but because they were the obvious choice, that wasn't going to be my team. And so for whatever reason at that age, I had a favorite letter, which was F. And I heard the name Philadelphia Phillies. And I thought, wow, like that's what a great name. All those F's. Couldn't spell, didn't right. Realize it was a PH. And it's as simple as that. From that point forward, I just grabbed on to Philadelphia sports.
Wow. Oh, so Philadelphia sports in general then too.
Yeah. Yeah. I became an Eagles fan and I mean, probably followed the Phillies and Eagles more than the 76ers and the Flyers.
So what makes you do the Wax Pack instead of doing like the Topps 1986 NFL pack?
You mean, football as in like?
Yeah, yeah. Why didn't you do that instead of the baseball?
Oh, why did I do baseball instead of football?
Yeah, for the first book, yeah.
Yeah, well, because I was definitely, baseball was number one. Okay. I collected baseball cards. That was really the thing. Like so many of us growing up, you know, would buy those packs of cards, those wax packs. And so had thousands of them. And so baseball was number one for me by far.
So you have a PhD in environmental science. How did you get into journalism in high school, or were you always a writer? How did you catch that bug that, cause you're a really good writer and I really enjoy both books. How did you get into that early on in your life, or?
Yeah, and it's funny you use the word bug because my PhD was actually in entomology, studying insects. but I got the other bug of journalism early on, and I remember my after my senior year of high school, I interned for a local newspaper here, the East Greenwich Pendulum, and then in college, I took a lot of journalism classes. I always had these parallel interests, you know, the right side of the brain, the more creative side was always about writing and journalism. The left side was the science brain. And my first job out of college was working in a magazine. So I worked for Islands Magazine out in California as a fact checker and got to write a lot of articles for them. And so had that training and then knew I wanted to go and do the science again. And that's where I did the PhD. And when I finished that, I decided, oh, I'm gonna do both. And so right after my PhD, I went to the LA Times to work on the science desk for this fellowship for a little while. And then I started freelancing, mostly science for science publications. And then I had the wild idea for the Wax Pack. And that set me off on this trajectory of sports nostalgia and Generation X nostalgia that has now produced a second book.
Now, let the listeners know, because I know the story, I read the book, but let the listeners know how you got on that journey to write the Wax Pack.
Well, I always thought a lot about those baseball cards we were talking about earlier, and I always liked, again, back to sort of my irrational interests. My favorite players were always the bench warmers and the journeymen, and so I always was curious about the guys that I grew up that were my heroes growing up, who were again not superstar baseball players, but I always wondered like what happened, what happened to these guys, like what did they do with the rest of their lives, because most of them are done by their early to mid 30s. And I had this idea of, what if you could take just a single pack of baseball cards from that era that had never been opened, and then just use that as the narrative device for a book where you say, okay, whoever's in this pack, I'm gonna go find those guys and tell their stories. And kind of the random nature of opening a pack and going with playing the hand that you're dealt. And I also knew just through sheer probability, right, that in a pack of 15 cards, most of the guys are going to not be the superstars. So it gave me an opportunity to indulge my own interest in those bench warmers. Because if I went to a publisher and said, hey, I want to write a book about a no-name baseball player from 1986, they'd be like, screw you. But if I say, yeah, I have this idea for the pack, then it has a lot more appeal.
It's really clever, and it was cool to read that book, and I felt the same way about your new book, where I just felt like I was like riding shotgun with you. I
Well,
felt like
good.
I
I'm
was
glad. I mean,
on the
that's kind of
journey.
that's a good sign, because these are, I like to say that I'm actually a travel writer. No, I'm not a sports writer. I'm not an entertainment writer, or not a pop culture writer. I'm a travel writer. And I've fully embraced that idea that, and that, it goes back to my where I was trained was in travel writing with Islands Magazine. And I these books, I makes me happy to hear you say that, because yeah, there is this kinetic feel to these books, because we're out on the road, I'm going from place to place, I'm describing the environments where I'm finding these people, and I really try to make that part of the story, right? It's not your typical narrative nonfiction, where it's just a lot of research that goes into, and this happened and this happened. It's like, well, let me tell you, let me take you to a place and show you what it looks like as I tell you what happened.
Speaking of research, how long did it take you to, that's your first book. How long did it take you to research those 15 players to figure out, okay, unfortunately, who's still alive? Where are these ball players across the country? Like, you go pretty in depth where you start to find, family members, or you're looking up stuff, high school yearbooks, those type of things. How hard was it on that first book to figure out, like, how you're going to put this whole plan together?
Yeah, you have to become kind of a detective. You become an investigative reporter. Probably spent over almost a year in prep for figuring out, again, the backstories and doing the reading on who the, their lives and their careers. Also knowing ahead of time what I wanted to ask them, because you have a very limited window with each person, and you don't want to waste any time. And so did a lot of research. And then, of course, not only do you have to do the research, but then you have to try to convince these people to talk to you, which
Right.
is not easy. I mean, and not all of them would. And that became part of the story in both books, where it's like, okay, if I can't get to this person, how can I still tell their story without their participation?
How many miles do you think you logged on that first trip?
Oh, I know exactly. 11,341. The second trip was 12,525. So those are number, it's kind of like in baseball, it's a very statistical game, and people have numbers burned into their memory of, 755 home runs for Hank Aaron. Well, I have my mileage, my odometer burned into my psyche.
That's amazing. I was curious, when I found out you were doing this book, and I want to talk a little backstory on it before we get into the book. But the one question I have before that is, what made you want to do the same thing all over again?
Well, I think it's that,
what you did, but like in a different, whole different.
Yeah. Well, that's the key, is that it wasn't the same thing all over again, but it was related. Like, right. So after that first book, a lot of people were like, oh, do another pack, you know, write another book just like that one. And I could have probably gotten a good book deal to do another, a direct sequel, but that wasn't creatively interesting to me, because that was a self-contained story. That story also was a lot of my own personal story. And, you know, I'm not vain enough to think that my personal life warrants a whole nother story in that same vein. So, but I had this second story to tell, which was because I had this backstory with the Iron Sheik, my favorite wrestler as a kid. So I figured out, you know, I wanted to tell his story. I wanted to return to the material that I had from 2005, when I had left my job at Islands Magazine to go work with him on a biography, and the whole thing went sideways and he was addicted to hard drugs and, you know, threatening to kill me. And I mean, that sort of sets up this new book. But I also just didn't want to write a straight Iron Sheik biography. I wanted to be more ambitious and go in and find his contemporaries and kind of do the Wax Pack treatment, where I go and find several wrestlers from the WWF from that era to tell a larger story, which, if the Wax Pack could be, the meaning of the Wax Pack could be described as being a book about vulnerability, this is, I'd say, a book about truth and this, the pursuit of truth in an industry of pro wrestling that is full of lies.
Yep.
Yeah. That's basically, it's based on a lie.
Yeah, it was interesting to me. It was funny because, you know, having read the first book and reading this book, my mind kept wandering back to like, man, how hard was it for him? Was it easier for him because he had the credibility of writing the first book? And was it easier to have more people help him on this book or not? And what I mean by that is like people being more, you know, helpful. Like the wrestling community seems like a really helpful community where they like to reach out and help and get stories told more. So I wondered what that was like, where if the baseball one was harder to do, where people didn't want to help you as much compared to the wrestling community. And there's, I don't want to give away the book because the book's great and you can let the listeners know what you want to talk about with the book. But I think how you did it was really smart, the way you did it. And I love how the chapters are done, which I thought was cool, you know. But what was the wrestling community like for you trying to navigate through this? Because a lot of the guys you're talking about now, because your book basically is in the late 70s, early 80s for the most part, and a lot of these stars, their careers went into the 90s and then even further than that, which is insane when you think about it. But a lot of these guys have to be in their late 60s to like mid late 70s.
Yeah.
So it must have been, I think, maybe even harder to do this mm-hmm. book. So talk to me about the wrestling community and what they did to help you out to make this book successful.
Yeah. Well, let's hope it's successful.
Oh, it'll be successful.
comes out April 2nd. We'll see. I would say, interestingly, that even though the Wax Pack did well, I don't think it made it that much easier to get people to talk to me or whatever. You know, I've been thinking about this, where there's so many, you have to get to the level of, a Bob Costas or something, a household name reporter, where I think people, it really changes the game and they say, oh, well, this person's coming to talk to me. Right. I think generally, and I actually kind of think it's good that I don't have a lot of that name recognition, because people are always more suspicious, or they have their guard up, or maybe they're performing more if they think that you're a big shot. So I like to kind of keep a low profile in my approach to potential sources and people to talk to. It was hard. It was hard in both cases to get the actual wrestlers or baseball players to talk to me, or to get to them to begin with. Wrestling was even harder in that the wrestlers, a couple of them, they wanted to be paid to talk to me. And I think that has to do with the fact that they were exploited in so many ways for so long. And so I get that. And I would explain to them, hey, like this is journalism. You don't pay your sources. And they would say, well, okay, I don't care. You know, I'm not going to talk to you then. And then I would say, okay, well, here's the deal. I'll pay you, but I'm going to disclose that to the reader. And that was very important for me. You know, I'm very much about honesty and transparency. And so I made sure to put in the book, here's what I paid this guy for his time. In terms of this, the rest of the community, the other writers, the people in wrestling, they were, yeah, you're right. They were very supportive, very helpful. And same with baseball. I've rarely encountered someone in either community that was overly territorial or, you know, hostile. Really, you know, and I like to try to pay that forward and help others where I can and, you know, promote their stuff. And it was very nice to get. I mean, people like Eric Bischoff, who is was a big guy in wrestling, as a promoter in WCW, was hugely helpful in putting me in touch with people, in helping me out. Lots of wrestling personalities, you know, also gave their time. So, yeah, that's grateful for that.
That's awesome, and I think it's important because it really helps tell the story. And I think there's a lot of stuff in wrestling where, you know, they didn't get a fair shake, especially in the WWF / E, right? It's hard for me to call it the E.
I always say WWF, yeah.
I can't call it the E. But where, you know, they weren't really treated fairly by the big boss, you know, I think. And I was just watching this special on the AWA the other night.
Yeah.
And it was funny because I, growing up back east like you did, WWF is what we watched, you know what I mean? And so you got cable, and then you could see, oh, there's other wrestling territories. And that guy's in the WWF. You see the older ones, right? And you realize the AWA had all these people that we grew to love in the WWF.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, Iron Sheik and Hulk Hogan, you know, got their big breaks in the AWA.
Sergeant Slaughter did too. I mean, there's so many. And then you start to realize, like, you know, if they had better production value, maybe there isn't the WWF that we know now. And I can see why they were so suspicious about, you know, wanting to get paid, because they had gotten taken advantage of. And you go into that in your book, which I thought was really cool and enlightening, with one of the wrestlers talking about actually going to trial for things. I'm going to give one little thing away in the book, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
I was really surprised that Mr. Fuji had CTE.
Yeah, well, I mean, here's the thing is, like, if you really start going down that rabbit hole, I mean, I would say, I mean, this is speculation, but I would bet like 75% of the guys from that era will have CTE. And a lot of these older wrestlers, when they kind of fade away and then they die, and they'll say, oh, you know, they died and they complained of dementia. And it's like, I mean, pretty much every brain, it seems like, that's been looked at from that era comes back with CTE. So I think it's just, it's like an epidemic among those guys.
Oh, totally. I was just surprised about Fuji because, you know, me and you, when we were watching, because we're around the same age, he was always a manager for the most part. He barely wrestled at that time.
Right. But he had a long career before that.
Yeah. But it was just crazy to think he basically managed for, God, a good, what, you know, 15, 20 years when we were watching. And then he ends up, you know, having CTE. And then you start thinking, wow, if he has it, with all the bumps that a lot of those guys were taking, I wouldn't disagree with you on that 75% number. And it's interesting because I think CTE is something that isn't talked about enough. And you know, the NFL is trying to make, you know, a better case of making players more safe and stuff like that. But with wrestling, you know, it's, you know, my little kid watches now, he's 9. And so I watch with him, and I'm kind of reliving my childhood through him. It's been kind of fun, but I watch a lot of the stuff those guys and girls do and go, ooh, man, this isn't.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that it'll be interesting to see this generation, because they're not working nearly as many matches.
That's
but
true.
The matches they do work are way more intense in terms of the riskiness and the athleticism, and you know, they're landing on their backs and their heads a lot. And so it's definitely scary what it could hold. But to your, just to give the listeners some, and I'm not worried about, giving away too much. I just to give them an idea of the basic idea of this book, the six pack. What I did is I took several of the wrestlers who wrestled on the December 26, 1983 Madison Square Garden event when the Iron Sheik won the WWF Championship. And that served as my wax pack for this book, right? Like, these are the guys I'm going to track down, were the people that wrestled on that card. And I didn't get to everybody, but I got to a subset of them. Plus Hulk Hogan, because he's so integral to the story, and he ends up becoming the champion a month later. And then, of course, Vince McMahon, because he's the promoter behind it all. And so I go across the country and I find these guys, and it's really about trying to figure out how, to what extent did each of them become their wrestling character in their real life. And also, another sort of subplot is the Iron Sheik story. As I said earlier, I had gotten to know him personally in 2005, had kind of had a falling out where we weren't able to write his book. But then the goal of this trip, which was in 2022, was to reunite with him and see him again. And then it turns out he ended up dying just a few days after I finished writing the book, which was kind of surreal. So that's sort of the narrative quest of the story. And yeah, I think anyone, I mean, the way that I try to present the book is that it's, if you're a wrestling fan, I think you'll like it. If, even if you're not a wrestling fan, if you liked movies like The Iron Claw, which came out recently, or The Wrestler, movies that portray the humanity of wrestling, you don't have to be a wrestling fan to enjoy them. That's what I'm going for with this book. And so it's not a typical wrestling book.
No, I completely agree with you. It's a story of youth, and it's a story of closure, and it's a story of behind the curtain, like we talk about the kayfabe, right? And trying to find the middle ground of who's in character compared to who's not in character when you're talking to them. Did you have any other experiences like the Sheik where you were afraid for your life when you were having any of these interviews?
No, I think most of the people were very down to earth. There weren't many times when I was talking to someone, I mean, other than the early Iron Sheik when he was just totally, crazy.
Right.
But generally speaking, there weren't many times when I was like, oh, this guy's trying to work me, or he's trying to claim something that's not true. I mean, I tried to present very clearly, like, hey, I've done my research. Like, I'm going to fact check you on whatever if you say something that's not accurate. And so, and I think I chose my line of questioning in such a way that would make it more difficult to for them to, go into their character.
What's something that you learned throughout these one-on-one interviews that really surprised you, that you maybe didn't know as a wrestling fan growing up?
Well, I think one of the things that I didn't know was I was able to break a lot of new ground around how the WWF was able to expand in the mid-80s and why Vince McMahon was successful. And I was able to track down his first CFO and his one of his senior vice presidents who was kind of his sidekick for many years. And it's sort of an investigation into how Vince McMahon was as successful as he was, and who Vince is as a person. And so I was surprised to hear how much, for example, Linda McMahon, his wife, what a big role she had in the company's success, because she doesn't get talked about at all in
Hardly at
that
all,
context.
right?
I mean, people know her as an on-screen character years later, but those early years when the company was like a dozen people or fewer, Linda was really the brains behind the operation. I think Vince was ruthless and ambitious and had a huge vision, but I think Linda was really the person who really made it work.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you on that. A lot of great women are unfortunately hid behind, in history when it comes to something, like a big corporation. It's nice to hear that. Here's another one I got for you. The press has been really good to you so far. It's been really nice to see that you're going to be on Jericho's podcast. And
Yeah.
what was it like seeing somebody like Bret the Hitman Hart writing such a positive review on your book?
Yeah, man, that, I mean, I think, you know, barring some, you know, crazy other thing that happens, I think I'll probably look back at that as like the coolest thing of maybe all of the, both of these books, right? To, I always felt like, I thought Bret would appreciate the book because he's always struck me as, I mean, I was never like a diehard Bret Hart fan. I always liked Bret Hart, but I wasn't my favorite. But I always respected him over the years because he always seemed like a guy that was about integrity and doing the right thing. And, you know, he could rub people the wrong way, or maybe he could be overly rigid in some of his perspectives. But I always was like, Bret Hart is one of these rare guys in wrestling that seems to be committed to the truth and doing the right thing. And so much of my book is about trying to tell the truth and getting to the truth. And, you know, both about what happened in wrestling and who these guys really are as people. And so I thought he would really dig it. And so I sent it to him, knowing it's a long shot. Bret Hart doesn't know me at all. I'm not a famous, you know, personality or writer. And I heard he wrote back, you know, very briefly, okay, you know, so yeah, I'll take a look at it. And I didn't hear anything for months. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, to get that email to land in my inbox, which is this, clearly he sat down and thought about it and wrote a very nice note about why he liked the book so much. That was one of those great days where it's like, wow, this is super. I mean, if you're going to, I mean, you inevitably lose some of your fandom when you do these books. You get to see behind the curtain too much sometimes, but that was one of those moments where like, you feel like a fan again, like, ah, that's awesome.
I was laughing because quoting your own book, I was thinking about the 6-year-old Bucktooth kid. I was thinking about what would that kid have thought about if you came back in time and said, hey, you're going to write this book about a bunch of wrestlers and this wrestler is going to say this, and your 6-year-old brain would have been like, yeah, sure, whatever.
I mean, and even more so, I mean, obviously the Iron Sheik way beyond even beyond Bret. I mean, the fact that I got Iron Sheik was my favorite as a kid. So the fact that I like not only met him, but like built a relationship with him and spent, you know, a couple months working with him and had the whole history that I have with him. My 6-year-old head would have exploded. That would have been by far the craziest.
Yeah, it's wild. It's the story is so cool. The book is really amazing. Thank you for sending me a copy beforehand so I can read it. And I really, really enjoyed it. I took my time with it. And there's so many great stories that, you know, wrestling fans are going to dig. But I agree with you. People that maybe just kind of knew Hulk Hogan's name or something like that could get into this book because it's really, you know, like I said, a book more about humanity. And I think closure and understanding, you know, people's stories, you know. And I think it's honestly amazing. Is there a story that you left out of the book maybe for time constraints that you could share with the listeners by chance, or did you really get to put everything in that you wanted?
Let me think. There was a whole chapter on Bob Backlund that I was going to write, but that didn't happen because of length constraints. And also from my research, it appears he may be dealing with some of those dementia issues.
Oh.
So that was, you know, going to be difficult. In terms of, what I will say is that I collected so much material from this project, right? I mean, I interviewed a lot of people that didn't make it in the book, and I have all this audio and I have all these internal documents. So if you're a wrestling fan and I have all these pictures, what I'm going to do is take all that additional material, and the same way with a DVD you used to have like the special features.
Yeah.
I'm going to have all that material on my new website, which I'm launching the same day as the book, called The Brad Pack, thebradpack.com. And I'm going to have all this additional material up there for people that are really into the subject matter to explore and check out. So I've always thought like books are kind of missing an opportunity to not, when they don't use all the material that they have. And so I'm looking forward to building this website that will also have like new material from baseball players and other people that I interview and new content that I come up with.
See, that's cool. It helps the people that didn't want the book to end to have something extra to, you know, dig their dig their teeth into. How much video did you watch? Did you watch a lot of video when you prepared for this?
I watched a lot of video like throughout my life growing up, sure. A lot of wrestling. You know, I didn't watch like matches just for the sake of it, but
right.
There were times when I would put in some matches just to get a sense of, if it was, especially if it was really relevant to the story, like in the Iron Sheik match with Bob Backlund or Hulk Hogan. There's one part where I talk about a match with Sergeant Slaughter and Hulk Hogan. And I watched that really carefully because, you know, that was relevant to the story that I was telling. Well, I'm curious. I'd like to ask you, Eric, sure. What were your thoughts on how the Wax Pack and the Six Pack compare, or how they're similar or different? Or,
well, I mean, I think they compare because you're doing the same thing in terms of the journey. But I think it's different because, you know, we can call it sports entertainment or sports. I feel like they're separated more, where, you know, of course, baseball players can tell fibs and things like that. But in wrestling for so many years, the kayfabe and protecting the business was a big thing. So for me, growing up, I was a huge baseball fan like you were. You know, I actually saw the Phillies play the Cubs at Veterans Stadium back in the day. And I went to one wrestling match when I was a kid. My dad took me begrudgingly, kind of like your dad probably did too, right? Where, but the wrestling one was really interesting to me because I liked seeing behind the curtain. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I like seeing.
There's that mystique in wrestling, yeah.
Yeah, but you know what? But the thing that was cool that you got across in your book, at least for me personally, was that these guys were human beings.
Right.
And a lot of, like, if you don't mind me saying for a second, talking about Bill Eadie, that was really cool to see. And some of the ways you told the stories of, like, when you were talking to him and the way that he had that, like, when he was not in Demolition.
He's a mass superstar?
Yeah, and he had that, like, you know, his promos were very, like, well, I'm going to come to get you and you're going to be in trouble. And, like, just the way he talked. But it was like, it was so, you know, great mic skills, like they say. And it was interesting to hear that part of the story when you were talking about that. It was just.
Right. And also something he said that was really cool, where he was like, don't overpromise. Like, don't say you're going to break someone's arm because you're not going to actually do that. Right. And so, like, these little subtle touches of how they would build those promos, it was really interesting to get into.
Completely interesting. And like I said, I didn't want to give away the card, which I thought that was cool that you did that. And there's one other story, you know, because I definitely have some wrestling guys that listen to the show, the OVP guys. And Greetings from Allentown. And there's a couple other ones that the Memphis Continental Wrestling Podcast listens to. So for all those guys that do a ton of great work behind the scenes and keep wrestling alive, especially the old school stuff, there was a lot of interesting things with let me think real quick. The Iron Sheik story about a certain thing with him taking the belt with him, and I don't want to give that story too
much. Oh, yeah, much yeah, away. Yeah.
And that was interesting. I think people are going to really dig reading that, because I think over time, when you like hear these stories, it's just like telephone, right? Where the story keeps getting, you know, more interesting and further from the truth and becoming more of this folklore. And, you know, so it was kind of neat. You know, I appreciated you doing the research that you did to kind of see, like, oh, so that's really what happened there. And you kind of went from a couple of different angles too, you know, which I thought was really cool. Like I said, I don't want to give away too much of the book, because I think a lot of wrestling fans, especially from that time period, are going to absolutely love it, like 100% love it. I think I attached myself more to this book because that was really when I got into wrestling, right around that time. So that was fresh because you saw almost the same guys wrestle every week on TV, right?
Yeah.
And with baseball, there were so many different players, so many guys you never even saw get into a game. I think that's the big takeaway for me between the two books.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. No,
if that makes sense.
Absolutely. No, I just, whenever I've talked to someone who's read both, it's kind of nice to get that feedback.
Oh, and I can tell you something right now. I don't remember if I heard about your book through the Topps podcast the 1988 Topps podcast. Mm-hmm. If you know about that one, I might have heard. I might have heard from there, but I remember getting it on Kindle, and I remember being really excited when I found out you were writing one about wrestling. Because I like, because I like that. And then the other thing too, man, like talking about the press, I just heard your name mentioned. Brian Last, from the Cornette podcast mentioned.
Yeah, I just did the Cornette podcast. We taped it yesterday.
Oh, awesome.
So I'll be on there next week.
Dude, he was so excited about your book. I mean, he was raving about it on it was probably a couple weeks ago, maybe on one of the episodes where he's just like, this is one of the best wrestling books ever written. And
oh, cool.
He was pretty hardcore about it. So that's very, very excited for you. So it's definitely making the rounds. So now I got to ask you this, and I'm sure people have asked you this already. Any plans to do a book tour like the like either of the books and go across the country and
oh yeah, I mean, like to promote the book?
Yeah.
No, I'm going to announce that soon. We've been working on it. I'm going to be hitting the road. Well, I'll be in Philadelphia for WrestleMania, going to WrestleCon and some of the convention stuff. And then I do my sort of launch is April 11th in Brooklyn, New York City.
Okay.
And then from there, late April, early May into June, I'll be doing a tour that will take me to, say, Providence, Boston, Syracuse, Chicago, St. Louis, Milwaukee, Des Moines, Lincoln, Nebraska, back over to Washington, D.C. So I'll be kind of doing a Midwest, East Coast loop.
Okay.
And, you know, we'll see if it works out, maybe do West. I mean, obviously I have roots in California, so maybe getting back out to California, West Coast at some point.
Well, let me know if you do the West Coast, man. I'd love to meet you in person and get a signed copy of the book. And I think that'd be really cool. I was laughing about that in my head going, I wonder if he's going to do the same crazy thing, like go 11,000 miles, 12,000 miles. And
well, you know, what's crazy is I had a even bigger book tour planned for the Wax Pack that got totally canceled by COVID. So, you know, it was all laid out. And then it was, middle of March. My book came out like 2 weeks later and just all fell apart.
Good old COVID, man. Good Lord.
Looking forward to avenging that this time around.
I'm excited for you. Before I let you go, and thank you for so generous with your time.
Sure.
Let me ask this first real quick. What's next for you in terms of writing another book?
The first thing is to really focus on this new bradpack.com sort of online magazine, which is going to have bonus content from this book, but also new content, again, new interviews, new material. I wanted to create something that's ongoing, that where people don't have to wait 4 years, for another book. Sure. I have ideas for a third that would make it like a pack trilogy, but it really depends, honestly, on the economics of like if this book does well. I mean, if publishing's rough, if the book does really well, it'd make it a lot easier to do a third one. If it doesn't, in publishing, you're kind of only as good as your last book. To make a living off of this, you have to have pretty good sales. So we shall see how that goes.
Yeah, it's hard too. I'm in the music biz, and it's funny, like, I think music and books go hand in hand together, where once we started losing all the independent music stores and bookstores, it became a lot harder to make a living being a writer or being a musician. So we kind of go hand in hand with that, which is everything's the internet age. And if it's not tangible, people don't feel like they need to pay for it. You know what I mean? And if you don't have enough stores available to house your music or to house your books, it's a lot harder to get those sales because it's not in front of people, if that makes sense, which I'm sure
absolutely
makes complete sense to you. All right, before I let you go, let's plug as much as we can of you listeners to find out where they can get everything.
Yeah, I mean, the book is, it's going to be wherever you get books, you can find it. So whether that's your local bookstore or online, it shouldn't be hard to find starting April 2nd. It's up for pre-order already. My website, thebradpack.com. I'm on social media, mostly on Twitter and Instagram at bradpackbooks. And so, yeah, please feel free to contact me, get in touch, let me know what you think. I like to engage with people on social media and, get their feedback. So, we'll see how it goes.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed our conversation today, and I really enjoyed learning more about the process of the book, which I think, honestly, all my listeners, you need to go pick up this book. It's well worth the read. And you will be engaged through the whole entire book. I promise you that for sure, 100%. So, Brad, thanks for your time, man, and enjoy your weekend.
Thanks, Eric.